You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, I'm super excited to dive into this week's episode and talk with one of my favorite people, Wendy Mays, who I actually have known now for a little bit over, at least over a year. In internet life, that's like a decade. We're old friends, but really this episode is going to be so much fun. We're going to get to dive into some really cool concepts. One of the things to me, there's two things about Wendy's story that's fascinating. And that is one, pursuing financial independence with a large family. This is something that's very easy to say, well, financial independence only works if you are two individuals making high incomes and you don't have kids. When you have kids, all this goes out the window. Wendy is crushing this game and is on the path to financial independence with not one or two kids, but actually with a tribe of six children. And her story just has so many actionable details because the strategy does change and it needs to be adapted for your specific scenario. The other thing about this particular episode is Wendy's path was not set at the age of 17. She found the perfect job and that carried her through the whole way. In fact, she had a massive pivot in her career trajectory somewhat later in life, in fact, relatively recently. And to really see how she's working through that, adapting it and using it on her path forward, I think is going to be of huge benefit for our audience. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, we had the good fortune of meeting Wendy and her husband, Curtis, at Chautauqua in Greece. Just incredible people. Their joy and energy, they're just infectious. And I just cannot wait to bring Wendy here to the Choose FI community. So with that, Wendy, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. I'm so excited to talk with you guys again. I feel like it's been ages, but it's really only been a couple of months.
Well, last time we talked, we were in Europe. So yeah, this is a friendship that transcends international borders. Let's dive into this. So you have a podcast that's blowing up. It's House of FI. You're creating incredible content. But today we wanted to bring you on the other side of the microphone and really find out more about your story and your particular path to FI. And I'm curious to set the stage here. When did you even become aware of financial independence? When did this actually even become a goal for you and your family?
Well, it was kind of a slow trickle and just kind of preparing for today's show and kind of looking at the timeline. I would say the first time that the FI community actually even appeared on my radar was about 4 years ago. At that time, we were in the middle of our final adoptions. I was also commuting back and forth between Phoenix and San Diego. I was living part-time in Phoenix. My husband was here in San Diego, and I was just really approaching full burnout. I just started searching. I was searching for some way to replace my income as a lawyer and do it virtually because our needs changed and we just needed to have more time available for the kids. And I just couldn't figure out a way. And so I was just doing internet research and I found the Mad Fiantist. And it was a mind-blowing experience. It was, I just couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that there are people out there who were working regular jobs and saving 50% of their income. So that was kind of the beginning. We didn't really do any sort of action steps. You know, we had done Dave Ramsey before and then got discouraged and fell into some old habits. It just kind of percolated. It percolated for a while until I was commuting back to Phoenix and I found your podcast. I found it in, I would say, March of 2017, and that's when just like the floodgates opened. I started consuming everything. I started consuming your podcast. I got J.L. Collins' book. I just consumed everything, and we created a plan. And from there, that was the beginning. I hope that answers your question.
So Wendy, buried in there, you talked about this commute from Phoenix to California. That is not a normal commute, as I understand regular life. Talk me through that commute, what you're doing in Phoenix, and what gets you to the point where you are making these Google searches on trying to find a different life?
Well, the desire to move to California was there for years. It is something that we had wanted to do for many, many years. And each year we would make a stab at it. Kurt would apply for teaching positions, and it just never seemed to happen. At the same time, he was looking for coaching opportunities. Things finally started to fall in place for him to go, but it made much more sense for him to actually live in California to get the positions. And so about at that time, we were in Phoenix for about 12 years. I was already starting burnout. So we were making this plan. We were making this plan to move. Our adoption with our first son was final. And so we were making our plans. And in the midst of all of that, our adoption plan changed, but we couldn't press pause on the move either because it was already in process. So that's kind of where things took a turn.
Let's talk about this turn for a little bit, because I know you have a large family. It's a family, 6 kids, and 4 kids are adopted. How do you go from adopting 1 kid to 4 kids? And how does this affect this kind of inflection point that we're talking about now, trying to decide whether or not to move or leave, Phoenix?
Okay. All right. Buckle up, guys.
That's staying.
it was a crazy, crazy thing to do at the time. And if we had thought about it too much, I don't think we would have done it. Things just happen. And we're believers. We're people of faith. We just really felt like this was what we were supposed to do. We were supposed to move. Things were falling into place for us. But at the same time this is happening, so I'm already commuting back and forth between San Diego and Phoenix so I could be with my husband on the weekends. I was taking my son with me. Things were just happening. My oldest biological son, Michael, went with my husband. My daughter stayed in Phoenix with me to help me. So that's already happening. We're already moving. In the process of that, Jacob had 2 little brothers that were born into the foster care system. So after our adoption was final with him, he has 2 brothers. They go into CPS custody. We get a call from CPS. Will you take these children? We felt, yes, we have to do this. This is our son's brothers. He deserves to know them. They deserve to know him. Yes, absolutely. So we take his brothers, and it was wonderful. It was beautiful. It was amazing to see my son knowing his little brothers. However, that situation became very bad very quickly. The mother had some time with one of the children, about 13 months at the time, and she just became very hostile towards us. It came to a point where we had to tell CPS that we can't have the children with us anymore because she was starting to make false allegations against us and things like that. My husband is a teacher. He can't have that kind of thing happen to him. But out of that process, it opened our hearts. We were then approached again by CPS if we would take 2 additional children. They were 2 little boys. They were brothers, not related to my son. But they were in CPS custody. They were getting ready to have their availability for adoption, and they wanted to find a family that would take both of them. They knew that we were losing the 2 boys, and they wanted to know if we would take these 2 boys. And we're like, gosh, we're in the process of this move. How is this going to work? But okay, we'll go and meet them. And that was kind of that was the end of it. We met them and it was instant love. We loved them both and we wanted them.
So if you're going through this adoption process several years ago, I think probably according to some of the articles you've written right around 2014, this puts you into a very interesting position because you have a successful law practice in Phoenix. You and your husband are moving to California. You are now inheriting a pretty long commute and you're doing it with a large family. And I think all of us can imagine the responsibilities that come with having, 1 child, much less having multiples of that. how did you handle that? And what did this do? Not for your relationship with your kids or even, but rather, at a larger picture, your overall quality of life. You have a lot of moving parts.
It was really difficult. Not going to lie, it was really hard and it was really, really challenging. So what I started to do with my practice was, because I was only licensed in Arizona, I wasn't licensed in California, and I didn't have any desire to be licensed in California, I was the breadwinner. My practice was the primary source of the bulk of our income. So I had to keep working, but I had to craft my practice in a way that would allow me to do the commute. And so I did a couple of things. I started limiting the days that I had to appear in court. So where I had flexibility with calendaring, I got very creative with my calendar. I used a lot of coverage if I could. Coverage is other attorneys showing up for me for certain simple things. But then I also eliminated parts of my practice. And that gave me more runway to be able to do the commute, but to also do it for longer and to get through the adoption process, because in the adoption process, things got a little complicated again.
So when you said you had no interest in being licensed in California, that strikes me as like, what's the plan, right? You're the sole breadwinner, as you say. What did you plan on doing at that point?
I was still searching at that point. I had been licensed as a realtor in Arizona for a very brief period of time as well, but I didn't really do anything with it. I had a few transactions there, but I never really did anything for it. So kind of at the same time, I was also still trying to figure out, what can I do? I loved working for myself. I loved being a business owner. I love entrepreneurship. And so I really started to consider, what could I do that a lot of my skills would transfer and where I also had unlimited income potential. And so that's how I landed with real estate. And so when things got a little less chaotic with the adoptions and all of that, I began the process in California to become a licensed realtor.
So you have a couple of things that are going on here, but from my perspective, a law degree is not inexpensive. You know, it comes in many cases for most individuals with student loan debt. Did you have student loan debt?
I did. And that is one of the biggest driving factors for why we needed to both have a source of income for me as well as reduce our debt.
To help our audience in terms of timeline here, a lot of the stuff that we've talked about is historical. And we're talking 2014, your family gets much larger, you're now moving locations and you're commuting between Phoenix and California. Sounds super simple. The simple path to wealth. Right. I'm curious. So like, I'm just doing some math and I know that you have 6 kids. Help me. What am I missing?
Right. So that was our life. That was our life for about 6 months. That, you know, we just managed. That's what we did. I would pack up the kids on a Friday or a Thursday and we would go see Kurt. And I would then return back to Phoenix the following, you know, late Sunday. And I would go to court. And that was life. We just made it work. Then I was in Phoenix. And it was a Wednesday, and I got a phone call. And usually when you get a phone call from CPS, it involves another child. And that's exactly what happened is CPS called. The mother of the 2 babies that we were in the process of adopting had just had a 3rd baby the day before. So he was 1 day old. They wanted to know if we would take the baby. Whereas before we could say yes immediately. Then I couldn't. Kurt was in California. I didn't know how we were going to do it. And so I said, give me a minute. I need to make a phone call. And so I called Kurt. He said, yes. I called them right back. I said, yes, we'll do it by that Friday. So in 2 days, I had the baby. I had this little, you know, 4-day-old baby. And we were on the road to San Diego that night. Walked in the door and handed Kurt the baby. And he said, my son. And that was it. That was Isaiah. That was our youngest, who's now 4.
You know, your heart for kids is just coming through. Obviously, like to the degree that you've gone to be able to offer a safe home for these children is just unbelievable. And I think for, you know, the people that are listening to this, we're inspired by you. And at the same time, we're wondering, how are you going to pull this off? You know, like there's this sense of, can you do this? And I got to imagine, even in your own mind, even after saying yes, you know, you're still dealing with the reality of, okay, it's based on math. It's based on time. Like you have a lot of obstacles that you have to work through in your case, just to get back to debt free, much less to be talking about a path to financial independence. as we're talking to you, we're kind of on this journey with you. We want to know, what are these points? What decisions did you make to optimize these different aspects of your life so you could give your best years and your attention to the kids that you're taking care of, to your family, quality time experiences, and still have a level of financial stability?
Right. So after we got Isaiah, the finish line for us, not the finish line, but more so like the next marker that we just needed to get through was the adoptions. And so we were very fortunate in that because of the way the system works, because we were already through the process of the adoptions of the other two, this was the third baby, that it sped up Isaiah's, and he was allowed to kind of join the track of the other two. And so it didn't delay the adoptions by much, but it did take almost a year. So it took until March of the following year for the adoptions to actually be final for all three. So that would put us in March of 2015. And that whole time we're planning, as soon as the adoptions are final, I'm going to be in San Diego more permanently. We're going to make the law practice have as little work required in Phoenix as possible. But that was the goal. And so we were working that whole year to make that happen. And so on March 25th of 2015, we appeared in court. The boys were then legally ours. And that day, I was in a U-Haul with the kids. Kurt came. We packed my apartment up in Phoenix, and we made the move to actually all be together as a family in San Diego.
Wendy, that is really, truly an amazing story. And I want to just focus real quick on the law practice. So at that point, you've moved to San Diego. You have a family of six. I know you talked about winding down the law practice, but was there any aspect of it that you hoped could be almost like passive income? I mean, was that ever the plan, or was it just, hey, we're shutting this thing down?
I did. And so what I did was I stopped doing trial work because I was a trial attorney. I don't know if we talked about what type of lawyer I was, but I was a criminal defense attorney. So I was doing homicides. I was doing, you know, armed robberies. I was doing, you know, some really bad stuff. And that's kind of what led to the burnout. And so, you know, you're fighting for someone's constitutional rights. It's a big thing. And so I transitioned from doing trial work to doing appellate work, which was more writing. It didn't require me to be in court nearly as often. And so that was the goal. That was the goal for a little while, was to just do fully appellate work. I could do that remotely for the most part. I'd have to appear in court, you know, maybe every few months, which was manageable. And so I did that for as long as I possibly could. But then, you know, the burnout was still there. And I just really felt like it was still just too much of an emotional drain, and I wasn't being the best lawyer I could be, and I wasn't being the best mom I could be, and I had to find a way to retire it fully.
I totally understand all the reasons you mentioned about this slow burnout and kind of this overwhelm and this feeling of not being able to be a good mom and practice lawyer at the level that you needed to be practicing at to justify both. But I also know that you're acutely aware of the numbers and you have a lot of obstacles in your path. I mean, you have a pretty high, I would imagine, multi six-figure student loan debt. I mean, if you're to get a law degree, at least six figures of student loan debt, and you have this, you know, long commute, and you're saying that you're the primary breadwinner. I'm sure that Kurt as a teacher is probably making more as a teacher in California than he was in Phoenix. But I'm just curious from your mindset, what does your financial picture look like if you decide to walk away from your practice, and what is the plan to alleviate that?
Jonathan, that was really the dilemma. That is kind of where I was at. I was in this place where I knew I couldn't do this for much longer. I knew that I wanted to be with my kids. Some of them have special needs, and I needed to be with them. And so it was desperately trying to find what I could do. And so that is kind of when I found the podcast. So that was in March of 2017, and I started consuming everything. So that is really when we put a plan in place. And when I say we, I mean I. because I have, you know, this 6-hour commute. That's all I'm thinking about is this plan. And, you know, I'm calling Kurt every like, you know, hour, 60 miles. We can do this. We can do this. And so I was creating this plan. It took a while for him to get on board, but he eventually did. But we created this plan. And what became clear was a couple of things. It became clear, one, that I had to reduce our expenses, and I had to do that drastically. But I also had to keep our income constant for a little while. Also, we needed to start saving. We had to do it. We couldn't wait anymore to do it. So we made a plan, and we just started working on it and working on it really fiercely for about a year until we could finally make some movement.
All right. So our audience, really, we're on this ride with you in terms of like living this out and hearing what levers you're going to pull. But just think, just to set the frame, the obstacles that we have a 6-hour commute. You're the primary breadwinner. If you make the choice for a better living situation, you're walking away from probably either an upper 5-figure or lower 6-figure income. But like certainly you're walking away from a pretty substantial amount of money. You've got at least $100,000 plus of student loan debt. And you've got, and I'm just thinking of structural expenses here. You have a large family. We talk about the three big ones being car, home, and food, right? And with 8 people that you're feeding in your home, there is a lot of food that's being consumed. And so I'm just imagining you on the 6-hour commute building your escape plan. How do I escape from Phoenix and this job that's no longer serving me and back to my family? What is the, honestly, this is the question. What does the plan look like?
Well, the first part of the plan was taking an honest assessment of where we were. And I did it pretty methodically. It was getting out all of the bank statements, using certain apps like Personal Capital and Mint, and plugging everything in and really seeing where our money went. Because, you know, it's almost embarrassing, but we were making really great money and had nothing to show for it. So I really needed to first see where the money was going. You know, some of it were fixed expenses that we needed to pay off or cut, just eliminate. But others were just ridiculous things, like almost $2,500 to $3,000 a month in food, which, yes, we're a large family, but we don't need to spend that much money on food. So it was really just that at first, just looking to see where we were, where was the money going, and then just one by one saying, to every single expense, is there a way for me to cut this or reduce it? And then doing it.
Wendy, so you described a astronomical food bill, $2,500 plus. What does that look like today? And what changes have you made? You know, we're always looking for these actionable tips. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I know in my own life that food is a way that we've managed to save significantly. I'd love to hear your tips.
Well, I can get our food budget down pretty far. We're really good about eating economical meals. And so right now I only budget about $1,000. And when I say that, that's not just food. That is our grocery store budget. So that includes things like dog food. That includes things like trash bags and paper plates. $1,000.
It really doesn't make a difference. It's like, how do you calculate your savings rate? Well, what do you consider savings? You know, are you counting the paper towels?
Yeah, exactly. So it's, if I go to, you know, wherever I'm going, Aldi or Walmart or Costco, it comes out of that $1,000.
So that's how you started. You started with this figure and you work off of that. So like, is that the big takeaway?
Well, yes and no. I really wanted to see how low I could get it. And so Google and Pinterest and all that, I saw an Aldi challenge and on Pinterest, and it was something like, you know, a week's worth of food for $50 and for a family of 4. And so I looked at it, I'm like, I wonder how low I could go with our family. And so for a month, I actually did an Aldi challenge where for our dinners, not every single meal, but for our dinners, I set a $75 food budget for the week. And my daughter and I would sit down every Sunday. We would make our menu for the week of our dinners. And then we would buy everything that we could at Aldi to see if we could stay under the $75. At that time, we were also eating vegan. And so we did it. We did 4 weeks, just dinners. We fed our family of 8 for $75 a week. It was great. It was amazing. Awesome.
That sounds impossible, right? Like how could you possibly do that?
And it was delicious. Like we weren't eating beans and rice. I mean, we were eating like stuffed pasta shells with like mushrooms and cashew cheese. And it was delicious. It really forced us to, number one, get creative, but also try new things and meal prep and meal plan, which I think all of those are just excellent tips for anyone who's trying to cut their food budget.
What I love about this, and I think you'll kind of see this theme throughout, is Curtis is just on board. Yeah, he is on the team. I don't think I've ever met a more supportive person.
Well, and you guys have had the benefit of meeting him in person. He really is good-natured, and he lets his crazy wife do all these crazy things until he finally has to say, okay, that's a bit too crazy. But for the most part, he lets me do just about any crazy idea I have. And thankfully, it's worked out so far.
So you're doing this somewhat crazy Aldi challenge, and this is probably bringing it to the extreme, but where do you eventually settle with your food budget? And what does that look like as compared to when you were doing the Aldi challenge, which albeit you really enjoyed? So, I mean, I don't think in your mind's eye you think of it as crazy, but you know, where are you now?
So right now I budget about $1,000 a month for food, give or take here and there, depending on, you know, big things that we're out of, like, you know, bulk paper towels and that kind of stuff. But it's right at about $1,000.
So I'm kind of just probably with the audience trying to do the math right alongside you here. And we are, you know, you're in Phoenix, you're trying to get back to California, you are split all over the place. You're loving Chooseify and you've got a 6-hour commute, but I don't think you love us that much. You're trying to get back to California. But you are a lawyer with a law practice. And while I, you know, I don't know exactly what you make, I would estimate that a law practice is probably making at least of, you know, an entry level six figures. And so if you leave that, you're walking away from a six figure income.
Yeah.
We've just covered how you cut down all the way from $3,500 a month at the high end on groceries, which is just, okay, you know, we'll just swipe it. It's fine. To, you know, the Aldi's challenge, getting you down to something below $500 a month pretty handily. And then you find this balance point with everything, which is still sub 1000. So you've been able to reclaim $2,500 a month to put back on the table and, you know, really optimize your life. But there's still a pretty big space there. And you've still got these student loans hanging out in the background. You're looking at the math the same as I am. What's next? This is the escape plan, right?
Right. So I had to make big cuts where I could. And so from there, it was really looking at, okay, what are the biggest things in our budget that we can eliminate and eliminate as quickly as possible? Because the more I eliminated, the less I had to earn to fill in the gap. And so there were bigger bills that we eliminated, like an old IRS, not like an old tax debt to the state, but also we had a trailer. We had a travel trailer that we were paying on monthly that we were using maybe once or twice a year, which was wonderful. And we had amazing memories there, but it was also sitting in storage for the bulk of the year and we were paying on it. Those were the types of eliminating that we did. We cut out as many of the big ticket items as we could. And then from there, we looked at other smaller things like cable, like credit cards, our Verizon plans, things like that. All told, we were able to cut a little over $6,000 out of our budget a month.
Wow. So this new financially intentional version of yourself has just created a space of $6,000 a month where there did not exist one before. Probably for the first time in your professional career, you have this massive bandwidth in your life, and you've done this with the subtext being you have a family of eight. This is, again, this is yet another point on that plan, on that escape plan. You've got, for the first time in your adult professional life, you have a $6,000 a month, and it's worth pointing out that this is an after tax, right? This is an after tax $6,000 a month space that you've been able to create. What do you do with that space?
Right. So, And I should mention that because of the move to California, my husband was making significantly more money. So his income had increased. Our costs for health insurance had decreased as well, which is automatically almost a raise. We were paying almost $800 a month in Phoenix for healthcare. So he got about a, you know, $500 a month raise automatically from that. So his income increased. Our expenses decreased. In the midst of that, we find Chooseify. We are not saving anything at that point. The only retirement savings we had at that point was what was mandated by CalSTRS. You know, 7 to 10%, I believe, is what they took out of his check. And that was it. So, you know, when we calculated in my income and his income together, our savings rate was really low, maybe under 5%. But we made a commitment that we were going to start contributing to his retirement. He was very lucky in that he had both the 403B and the 457. So we made a commitment in January of 2018 that we were going to max out those retirement plans. In January of 2018, we did that. I also started putting a little bit into mine, not a whole bunch, but a little bit. What we did during the course of 2018 was we increased our savings rate to about 38%. That was kind of the keep going with the plan. We're increasing the savings rate. We're paying off the debt. We're executing this plan for me to be able to leave my practice. In about October of last year, October of 2018, I felt we were in a comfortable enough place where we have gotten our expenses down far enough for me to actually close the practice. I was doing my real estate. I made about $40,000 in the real estate business last year. So I felt that we were in a place where I could actually close the practice. And so in October of last year, I finally closed the practice.
So to highlight that, essentially in your mind, you know, if I'm trying to make up some income and, you know, what, let's just assume for the sake of this example that your income is $120,000 a year. You know, it's a 10 grand a month difference that I need to make up. You've chopped out, you know, $6,000 a month in after-tax expenses by just optimizing everything else. So that takes care of the one half. And then on this other, you've side hustled. Essentially, you've got a real estate license now, and this is now turning into a full-time thing, which is then picking up the rest. And now you're back to, well, essentially in your mind, even as you were doing this, you were pulling off a 38% savings rate. So by just kind of tightening in, focusing on things you value and getting rid of the things you didn't, but being cognizant on the money and what the numbers actually said about the budget, you were able to still have incredible results.
Right.
Yeah, this is exciting. Now I'm curious, there were a couple of things you mentioned there, and I want to come back to adoption and pursuing this with a larger family, just because you've been living this out. You know, these kids and this adoption process has been part of your life now for several years. I would imagine that you would have some insights for audience, for people that are wondering, you know, of all the different factors that we mentioned, not the least being you left a pretty lucrative job that was in another state. How did actually adopting the kids have an effect on not only your finances, but also on your path to FI?
Well, they're really our big why. So as far as like the path to FI, they are the absolute overarching reason for our want to retire early. And when I say retire early, I mean retire from traditional careers where Kurt won't have to work as a teacher anymore, where we can do the things that we want, like the podcast, and maybe do like an Airbnb or something like that. So they're the overarching why, but they're also, we just get creative. We get creative with everything. I mean, we have larger housing expenses, of course. We have larger vehicle expense. I have a Suburban because I just can't bring myself to get a minivan. So
minivan moms unite against this episode.
We just do. We just have bigger expenses. We have bigger clothing expenses. So, you know, we just really try and optimize everything. So our Suburban is not brand new. The kids' clothes are not brand new. We often welcome hand-me-downs from friends and neighbors. When we do something with the kids, we try and do it as inexpensively as possible. So, you know, if we actually do go to a theater, we go to the matinee theater at the discount theater where I can pay for 8 tickets for $40. You know, we just really try and have fun as a family, but for as cheaply as possible. And we go to the beach. I mean, we live in San Diego. Who can't have a great day at the beach? So it's really just about looking at every single area of our life and figuring out, okay, how can we not decrease the quality of our life, but at the same time, do it as inexpensively as possible.
So when you're describing your kids as your big why, and also it sounds like this fun creativity in a sense that you and Kurt and the family get to enjoy this newfound life, this FI lifestyle. Fast forward for me. Have you gamed out the path to FI, like when Kurt can leave his job? What does the future hold for you?
Yeah, we do have a plan. And you know, we have a pretty audacious plan, actually, you know. But it does involve Kurt staying at the school district until he's 55. The reason for that is that at 55, he becomes eligible for a lifetime pension. You know, it's not going to be a lot of money, but it's certainly enough money that it makes total sense for him to stay. But it also gives us time to pay off our student loan debt. The other thing that we're going to be doing probably in the next month or so is that we're going to do one more budget optimizing choice, and that is we're going to sell our house and become renters again so that we could save anywhere between $1,000 a month to $1,500 a month by paying rent versus a mortgage, but also free up some of the equity in our house to do some pretty awesome things with that money. So the plan is for the next 7.5 years until Kurt retires to just really continue working this plan, building up our savings, becoming debt-free, so that when he does reach 55, we can go anywhere we want. Maybe we go to Portugal and we live there. Or maybe we find a little beach house in North Carolina and we raise our kids there, because our boys will be tweeners and in high school, and we will still have a whole lot of life left to just enjoy them.
So you guys have a 7-year plan to your version of financial independence, and that is being directly driven by your why. And to set the frame, 2 or 3 years ago, you had never heard of this concept. At the beginning of last year, you were engaging and interacting with as much of this content as was possible. And then very quickly you were taking action on, and because it's based on math and you know what options are available to you, you're going to be able to have your version of this within a decade. And you're inspiring people along the way, because so many people say, this is an option for me because I have a large family. This isn't an option for me because I have too much debt. This isn't an option for me because I found this too late in life. Do you get more excited with each additional month or 2 months or 3 months of progress that you make toward this joint vision that you and Kurt have?
I do. I get extremely excited when I think about it, because it was such a place of hopelessness. I really did not know what we were going to do. I really felt like there was no way out of the debt situation. I really felt like I was going to be stuck in my career forever. So it really was this just awakening. And it is so exciting to think that, yes, absolutely, you know, God willing, we're all healthy and all of that. And in 7.5 years, we're going to get to do this dream, this big dream. But I also want to just say that doesn't mean that it's been easy. It's not easy. It's been incredibly hard. And there are days when I feel very defeated, and like, you know, you just get to those places sometimes. And the one thing that I do try to do just to kind of bring things back is that I track everything. I track our progress. I track what we've paid off. I've got, you know, memo post-its all over my office. I've got this yellow legal pad where I've tracked what we've paid off, because I have to come back and I have to look at it. I have to come back and say, wow, in 18 months, we've decreased our negative net worth by almost $90,000. Wow. We made a 38% savings rate last year. This is how much we've decreased our monthly expenses. We've done a lot of hard work, and it was hard. Sometimes you just run out of steam and you need that motivation. So it's always a good idea to look back at where you've come, because sometimes you forget. And that is what keeps us inspired, is seeing where we've come from.
Yeah. And isn't that the beauty of FI, right? Like, to even take a more macro look at this, you were a successful lawyer. Kurt had a job in Phoenix. You guys lived in Phoenix, and you had essentially a negligible savings rate on the two salaries, right? And then by following this path, by finding first the mad scientists and then finding us and actually really diving into what your why is, you were able to cut out $6,500+. It sounds like more than that now that you're going to be a renter. The changes you've done, and oh, by the way, you're not a lawyer anymore. What a crazy journey when you really look at that on the huge macro level. I mean, Wendy, it's just truly remarkable.
Well, thank you. It doesn't make sense. But I do think that, you know, people really do need to get creative and take risks and surround yourself with other people who are like-minded. You know, Jonathan, you've talked about it recently on other shows, and, you know, surrounding yourselves with people who are like-minded. And it's so true. And if you just don't have those people in your life, there's podcasts, there's books, there's blogs, there's communities, there's meetups, you know, go find people who will motivate you and encourage you and give you tips and show you different ways that you can maybe, you know, change your thinking.
I can't tell you how appreciative we are for you being able to come in and share your story with such authenticity. I wanted to actually just take just a second because I know there are individuals that are either have already adopted like you or are looking into the process because they feel that similar calling. I'm curious if you could relay any actionable information for people that are wondering what resources are available, what things, you know, you don't know what you don't know until you do. This is what you know.
So if we're talking about adoption, I would say, first of all, there are several different types of adoption. Of course, there's domestic adoptions, domestic private adoptions, where people, you know, use lawyers, use the courts, get matched with a birth mom. That's one route. And as everybody probably knows, that that costs a lot of money. There's also private international adoptions, which are essentially the same thing. You're using the courts, you're using attorneys, you're paying some hefty fees. So that's a barrier. Adoption can be expensive. And so if there is anyone who believes that adoption is a barrier to them because of the finances, I would simply encourage them that there is another option. And that option is to adopt via the foster care system. Every state has their own guidelines. So I'm going to speak to just in general terms. Typically, if you are interested, it's usually either very, very low cost or no cost. Every single state has their own procedures, but one of the very first steps is you can go to an informational meeting. And those are usually free. They're no obligation. It's for you to just explore. For us, every single one of our adoptions was free. We had to have a home study with each one, and that was really the only thing that we paid for, and that was $800. And that was reimbursed to us after the adoptions were final. When it came time to do the adoptions, our attorneys were paid for, so we did not have to pay for the attorney. That was paid for through the state. And then after the adoptions were finalized, we received some additional supports. We received a monthly subsidy for each one of the boys. Then that's because they were each born substance exposed, and so they're considered high risk, as well as sibling group. So that's another basis for the subsidy. So we get ongoing support for them. It's not a lot, but it absolutely helps and defrays some of the costs that we have from having so many children. And then the other financial benefit, which I would check with your financial person if that's still available, is that with every single adoption for that year of adoption, we got a $12,000 credit, which was very helpful. And that was per child as well. You know, there's just other financial benefits that continue. Not to say that these are reasons to adopt, but they're certainly addressing some of the concerns that people might have that would preclude them from adoption. Some children receive educational scholarships afterwards, and then all of our boys get secondary insurance through California. It's Medi-Cal in Arizona. It's Access. And I would assume that that's true in other states. So, for instance, if our children had a large medical procedure that was not covered by our primary insurance, Medi-Cal would kick in. Or if we were without insurance, they would have Medi-Cal.
Wendy, you have a wonderful podcast, and I'm sure that there are people that are listening to this that are going to want to find out more about the topics that we've discussed today, but also find out more about what you're working on generally. What's the best way for them to connect with you?
Absolutely. So our podcast is House of Phi, and we can be found at houseoffi.com. And actually, we are launching a course. It's going to be basically a podcast 101 course for beginners, college level quality, and that will be live by the time this airs. And they can find that on our website as well.
So on most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But Wendy, on this show, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I am.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Wendy, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Oh, I'm going to go to J.L. Collins just because he was so impactful in our life and just really making the whole idea of investing in retirement accounts in a way that we could understand.
Awesome. Well, question number two, your favorite article of all time. Now, this can be one that you wrote or somebody else's.
I'm going to say that it's still out there on one of my old websites, and that's at wendymays.com, but it's a 6-part series and it tells the whole ins and outs of our adoption story. And I still get choked up sometimes when I go over it. So I just really want people to understand that adoption is an option for them, but also I want to be as transparent as possible. And so our story is there and they can find out more about our journey and what they can do if they're interested in adoption. And that's at wendymays.com.
That's very cool, Wendy. And yeah, we'll definitely have those linked up in the show notes for sure, so everybody can check it out there. But let's go to question number three, your favorite life hack.
Oh, my favorite life hack that I have totally neglected is getting up early and getting your workout in early in the morning, anywhere between 5:45 and like 5:15, just getting up, even though it's hard, and getting in at least like 30 minutes of working out, followed by another 30 minutes of like personal development. So either reading a book or listening to audio, just really sets the tone to your day and you're just energized after that. And I just seem to get so much more accomplished when that's how I start my day.
I get up every morning currently right around 6:30. I was trying to do that whole 5 a.m. thing, but I haven't quite pulled that off. It was very good
it's
about
hard.
It the first week of January, but like this is the last week of January. Motivation
hard.
Levels has waned.
But once you get into a routine, like once you actually do it and do it consistently for, you know, a good month or so, you know, your body adjusts. But that first few weeks is really hard. Not going to lie.
All right, question number four, your biggest financial mistake.
My biggest financial mistake was not being educated about student loans and student loan debt and taking more than I needed, not utilizing community college, getting as much, close to free education as I could, and just thinking that I'll just pay this off later. I'll just, I'll get a job and I'll pay it off later, because that doesn't always work out.
Wendy, how long do you think it'll take you to pay off your law school debt from start to finish?
Well, I've got to increase my income with real estate. And now that I'm actually working it full time this year, I'm hopeful that I can get back up to close to 6 figures this year. If I do that, and if we keep our savings rate where it is and not decrease it to speed that up, I'm hoping we could do it in 5 years, but it might take the full 7, because I'm not going to, I really don't want to stop the retirement savings at all. We held that off for so long that I really hate to reduce that.
Awesome. All right. Question number five, the advice you would give your younger self.
The advice I would give to my younger self is I should not worry about what other people think, that I should just be who I am, that I should embrace that and do the things that I love and I enjoy and not be so concerned about what other people think.
When you look back at your life that you've lived up to this point, you think about the times that you have really, really cared what other people think. What has that done to the path that you're on? And if you had followed this advice, what would be different?
Well, I don't think I would have started a podcast. I don't think I would have given up my law practice. So those are, those are really unconventional things. You work all that time and effort to get a law degree and to just walk away from it. Or who am I to have a podcast? What do I have to say? Some of that imposter syndrome,
yeah.
Yeah. So just those sorts of things, just worrying about what people think of my choices instead of just embracing what's right for me and what's right for our family and going full steam ahead.
Yeah. And I think, like you said before, it's because of that big why, right? You don't care about what other people think when you have that big why. So good on you guys for sure. And Wendy, we've got one last bonus question. So what's the purchase that you've made in roughly the last 12 months that's added the most value to your life?
Well, it wasn't for me. It's for my husband.
Is it sock related?
No. Okay. So I don't know if you guys know this or not about Curtis, is that he loves to vacuum. He loves to vacuum. He loves to mop. He loves clean floors because he's a bit OCD. And so I bought him one of those shark ball vacuums. No, Dyson, not a shark. It's a Dyson.
I was going to say it wasn't a Roomba because that kicks him out of the equation.
No, it's a vacuum because he loves it. He loves it so much and he'll vacuum. I haven't had to vacuum in I don't know how long, a big percentage of our marriage. He finds it relaxing and he just does not like dog hairs. So
that's so that funny. And my joke about his socks, Curtis is a sock lover. He has, I think he said like hundreds of different pairs of like these awesome socks. I think he probably wants to keep his socks clean, right?
He totally does. And that increased at Christmas time. He got, I would say, at least 20 new pairs of socks at Christmas time.
Nice. Chautauqua 2020.
Yes.
Wendy, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, gosh. Thank you guys for having me. It's been so fun. It was so good to talk to you guys again.
You know, Brad, what an incredible story, how quickly you can turn something around and get on a path to financial independence. You know, you like this idea of you just did everything right. You're at the age of 20. You found out about financial independence. You don't have any debt. But that's the vast minority of our audience. Most people have stuff that they have to clean out, hard choices that they need to make in order to really create space to pursue this audacious goal of reclaiming not just your golden years, but your best years. And to see how she made these choices that we were describing and implemented them in her own life and basically built a path for herself to financial independence with about a 7-year runway. That's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And I loved how we walked through like these specific actions that she took to get there, right? Or to be on this path. And I know I mentioned this in the episode, but when you really take that macro view of what she did, it's remarkable. I mean, to go from having two very nice combined salaries with essentially no savings rate to making this absurd change to leave your successful and thriving law practice and then have the savings rate and then have the path to FI. It's amazing. This is what FI is all about.
And we didn't talk about it enough. You know how many people say, oh, I'm in my job, but it's a really high paying job, but it's toxic. It's killing me slowly, but I just need to keep my head down for another 7 years. And then I know I'll be there. Well, I mean, one, okay, if that's what you want to do, but you don't have to do that. That doesn't have to be your future carved out. You could reprioritize your life to figure out another path. And if you don't have any ideas on what it would look like, you can look around or you could position yourself to receive new information to come up with ideas and find a variation. It's rarely binary in life. It's what path do you want to take? To our audience, if you got value from today's episode and if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. It just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us in what we're doing here at ChooseFI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth one life hack at a time.